What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. With Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, a member of our film critic Mount Rushmore. Nice to see you again, Michael.
Thank you. I can't shoulder the burden of that comparison. I'm sorry.
Well, speaking of chiseled faces.
In his book, Euclid says this is self-evident. You see, there it is. Even in that 2,000-year-old book of mechanical law, it is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
That's Daniel Day-Lewis as the towering titular 16th president in a scene from Steven Spielberg's latest. This week, we'll discuss Lincoln and consider whether we hold the director's top five scenes to be self-evident.
We'll also concentrate, like it's a plate of mashed potatoes, on one Spielberg classic, 1977's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's a Spielberg spectacular ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by FreshBooks, the cloud accounting service for small businesses that saves time and gets you paid faster. Join over 5 million FreshBooks users and try the service free for 30 days of unlimited use at FreshBooks.com. Be sure to let them know you heard about it on Film Spotting.
We're also very excited to have a first-time sponsor on board this week, Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or any other type of film project. You can choose from over 700,000 high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. We heard from a couple Film Spotting listeners, Josh, on Facebook, who use Shutterstock, including John Johnston, who said, "My company uses Shutterstock for everything from magazine ads to product packaging. Good pricing and a large collection of images have kept us subscribers since 2008.
We also heard from Molly Dumbleton, who wrote in, "I build short videos and interactive games for children, so I use Shutterstock all the time. I often need a stock clip of something simple but very specific and a hassle to shoot, like a dog running, a steam train arriving at a station, someone playing a particular kind of drum. Shutterstock has been a really good find."
They source video clips from around the world and put them at your fingertips, and many of their contributors are professional filmmakers. They add 10,000 video clips each week, so every time you visit the site, you'll find something new.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start your account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like and save video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM11, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM11.
We thank Shutterstock for their support of Film Spotting. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam, Josh, and Michael Phillips. There's going to be so much Steven Spielberg talk this week, J.J. Abrams might just send us a harassing email from a Gmail account. I think it could happen. And I don't want to spoil the top five for you guys, but I'm warning you now, all of my favorite Spielberg scenes come from his segment of Twilight Zone, the movie.
I knew you were going to go for the one Spielberg I haven't seen.
Deep cut. I just knew it.
We're also going to feature some of our favorite Spielberg-John Williams musical collaborations. But first, our honest opinions of Honest Abe's movie.
We here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
We can't tell our people they can vote yes on abolishing slavery unless at the same time we can tell them that you're seeking a negotiated peace.
It's either the amendment or this Confederate peace. You cannot have both.
How many hundreds of thousands have died during your administration?
Congress must never declare equal those whom God created unequal.
Read the Constitution alone.
We are stepped out upon the world stage now, with the fate of human dignity in our hands. Blood's been spilled to afford us this moment. Now, now, now!
How much respectability can one movie maintain? Lincoln comes from perhaps our most universally esteemed working director, Steven Spielberg. It stars an actor usually spoken about in hushed tones, Daniel Day-Lewis. And the subject? Nothing less than Abraham Lincoln. I wonder, Adam and Michael, is this our greatest president being portrayed by our greatest actor under the direction of our greatest filmmaker? Add to this the seriousness of the movie's focus. Rather than a birth-to-death biopic, Lincoln centers on the politicking and strategizing Lincoln engaged in during the waning days of the Civil War in order to win passage of the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery. When a project is surrounded by this much esteem, it can be suffocated by its own reputation and sense of self-importance. Do either of you think that that happened here? Is this a wax museum of historical respectability, or have these genuinely talented movie artists managed to make something that's also invigorating and alive?
I really love this film, Josh, and it to me, that sense of kind of inflated solemnity or kind of maybe an artificial kind of grandeur that some Spielberg films in the, quote, serious realm can be accused of, I think. I mean, everything from Amistad to The Color Purple to some aspects of even a very fine film like Schindler's List. This film, Lincoln, is really kind of wonderfully free of all that. It's a much smaller, more modest, and surprising film than I would have expected. I think partly it's because he's dealing with a very interesting and tightly focused script by a terrific writer, Tony Kushner, who's focusing on just a few last four months of Lincoln's life, the passing of this 13th Amendment to abolish slavery. And it doesn't have that kind of epic sweep or that sense that the story and the film itself is taking on the world. You know, it's not taking the weight of the world and the momentousness of this piece of this moment in history on its shoulders. It's a much more nimble film than that, even though it is highly and densely verbal and arguably a little static. I mean, I have to admit, I've seen it to the degree I care about how the person on the left or the right seems to be responding to anything I'm seeing, any of the 300 things I'm seeing a year. Both times I saw Lincoln, people were conking out right and left. A little bit, they were. I don't think they were used to or ready for the kind of dialogue sequences this film rests on. I mean, these scenes, the film is much closer to a really good Tony Kushner play than what we commonly consider a Spielberg movie. And
just about all the drama does depend on dialogue.
Dialogue, but I just think this is one of these. Now and then you get a movie that is not particularly, it's not form busting or formally inventive or anything, but this is a solid, honest to God, three auteur success. You have Spielberg, I think it's the best film in at least 10 years. You have Daniel Day-Lewis doing really exquisite work as Lincoln that gives you a little bit of the myth and a little bit of the icon. But really, finally, you see Lincoln as a human being, I think. And also, Kushner's script is the major, kind of the major player, like it or not, you know, that you're getting with this film. And I, for me, all three work beautifully together. But Adam, what do you think?
I think that's very convincing. Unfortunately, I think it would have been a lot more convincing if you had John Williams' score swelling behind you the way Lincoln and every other good guy in this film does when they have something halfway profound to say. I remember getting to the end of this film and watching poor Jackie Earl Haley representing the Southern delegation there for a peace negotiation. I was thinking, this is a totally unfair fight. Abraham Lincoln has the score. He has his own accompaniment.
No, but wait a minute. No, I don't buy that. This is. I mean, I don't love the score, but even for John Williams, this is a remarkably muted and not down your throat musical score by his standards.
If this is muted, then I don't want to hear anything else he's done. And I know he's done some great stuff. I'm sure we're going to mention a few of them as we get through the show and we get to our top five Spielberg scenes. But I think Josh set it up perfectly. In terms of what's wrong with this film, you hit on it in describing what you think works, which is the lack of solemnity and grandeur, or it working despite all that. I wish it worked despite all that. Those are the words I'd use to describe this film, and I think it's a film that ultimately is suffocated by its pomposity and its self-importance. And the music, for me, is just the most egregious offender. On cue, every time a dramatic scene was going on screen, I knew exactly when the president would hit on some bit of virtue for us to consider. And sure enough, the music would would come in, the violins would swell in.
It doesn't.
And,
no,
and like,
no, it doesn't
like
sound
Pavlov's
like that.
Dog, we would instantly start salivating and just take in
it's
all
not
of his
like
greatness.
That. Now you're. I think you are describing the kind of Spielberg movie I feared this would be, but it just simply doesn't play out that way. Ed.
That
it does not.
Is exactly how it played out for me, and I went in with no expectations of what it would be as a Spielberg film or not a Spielberg film. But I do think this is a movie that commits the cardinal sin of any biopic or biopic type film, which is presenting the characters, I'm sorry, Josh, as not living, breathing people who are dealing with, yes, monumental tasks of major historical significance, but nevertheless, they're just men and women struggling to make the right decisions. They're living day to day, moment to moment, lacking or should be lacking any real awareness of how their actions may be viewed in the future. And nevertheless, that's how I felt watching this film, that was imbued in every scene, which struck me as odd considering, as you touched on, Michael, it's really about politics. It's not really about the people at right. all. If you think about the people and trying to inspire the electorate, they're really completely non-existent in this film and only mentioned once by Tommy Lee Jones' character sort of derisively. So this is really the
nuts
and bolts.
Okay, this to me is one of the strengths of the movie.
I agree with you that it is
ultimately. It's not a matter of everybody sort
of
like speaking to the history. Mm. You know?
I think it is a strength of the movie that it is more about the nuts and bolts political machinations. Nevertheless, I feel it completely contradictory in the way Spielberg and Kushner frame the movie as ponderously as they do, with the music mainly, but also with the cinematography and, unfortunately, a lot of the dialogue.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson with Adam Kempinar and the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips. Adam, I was with you probably for the first 5 minutes. That opening scene, oh man, I was really afraid this thing was going. We get Lincoln sitting pretty much as he is in the statue that's in Washington, D.C. That's the pose he's striking. There are two black Union soldiers looking up at him worshipfully, and then other soldiers join them. They start to recite the Gettysburg Address
to
him.
Let
me just tell you where I'm going, because I think Adam is right for 5 minutes.
Okay.
That scene is brutal. It's exactly what I feared. Once the black Union soldiers start completing the Gettysburg Address, I wanted out. I will admit, I wanted out. That is a bookend with another unfortunate scene at the very end of the film that I think is a big mistake, and it represents a mistake Spielberg often makes.
Yeah,
in
I was
trying
say
to
from Spielberg.
Heighten.
That's shocking.
Well, it is a mistake that you see in many of his films. In between, I think you're writing a lot off, Adam. I think there is a lot of nuance, a lot of tact, and a lot of real grit to this film that shocked me.
Well,
that's where I completely got on board.
This is fascinating to me because I had a completely different reaction to that opening scene, which has been, you're not the only guys who have taken exception to this. But as you're describing it, Josh, both times I saw this film, I didn't experience any of what you're describing the same way. When I see, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis, as Lincoln, just sort of sitting on the back of this wagon, I don't see a monumental pose. I see kind of a tall, stooped guy just mm-hmm. sitting, listening, talking to some soldiers. The key thing for me in that opening scene where you have two sets of Civil War soldiers heading off to battle in a week or so. One African-American pair, although I don't think they called them that then.
Probably not.
And then, you know, one white pair. So the key thing of that scene for me is that one of the black soldiers is basically, you know, is discreet and in a semi-plausible way historically, is basically busting Lincoln's chops for, is this guy all talk and no action? You know, does he care about the unequal pay issue between blacks and whites? You know, and that's what gives that scene a kind of a peculiar tension. There's sort of this weird bickering going on between the two guys, and it's all kind of happening, and Lincoln's kind of uncomfortable. And that is not what you're describing, Josh.
But wouldn't
you're describing a bunch of speechifying that would come
That's
out
what
of,
it became, Michael.
That is what that opening scene. And look at it in contrast to the other much better scenes that the majority of the film is made up of. Mm. Look at that opening scene, the framing, the positioning, the use of music, the way the characters are speaking and what they're saying, compared to the many dialogue scenes in between that are just nitty-gritty, nuts and bolts, political debates, very impassioned arguments about the subjects and the legislative process. Those things Spielberg makes extremely suspenseful for me, and the screenplay does as well, and the acting. You're right. It all comes together in those scenes in such a different way than in that opening scene. They're completely different styles to me.
Yeah, I did not experience that opening scene the same way, and believe me, I came out of, I mean, going into this film, I actually felt kind of a wariness that I haven't felt with a big Oscar bait movie in a long time, in that we're talking about, what was the last Spielberg film? War Horse, correct?
Mm-hmm, right.
And that's a film I really didn't have much engagement with. I felt like the technique was just down my throat the whole time. You know, the old Hollywood artifice and the corn of that movie, you know, was just shameless. And I thought, okay, here we have Spielberg again working with all the usual top flight collaborators, but I just felt like, you know, should he really work with Janusz Kaminski, the cinematographer, again? Should he be dealing with the same editors, Michael Kahn, the same composer, John Williams?
I would say, based on this, no to all three.
Well, based on War Horse, I would have said that, but I really felt like they took a very different tack with this film. It just doesn't, to me, it does not feel like a Spielberg picture. It just feels like a newly engaged and very carefully considered and kind of low-key version, and a really mature director working at the top of his game. And well, I haven't felt that way in over a decade about this.
War Horse, which I liked, did have that sort of exaggerated color palette. It was done by colored pencils, and here you have some of the same people doing something completely differently, where you can feel the soot in these rooms. And I think the approach they take to the film visually is a plus. It really adds a lot to the film. I feel like I'm on the side of, you know, it sounds like I'm denigrating the film when I actually did like it quite a bit, and I want to give some time to what I appreciated about it, and it is that focus that you mentioned too. I really did appreciate, Adam, how this was all about the vote. And this is something like, I've never watched C-SPAN, but essentially what you're getting here is C-SPAN, historical C-SPAN, and it's
With better hats.
And beards, yeah, yes. Yeah. And when they get to that final vote to pass the 13th Amendment, first of all, it's that historical framing to make us realize that this actually came down to a vote. You know, people had to sit down and say yes or no to something as momentous as this, which we forget or don't even think about. And the way Spielberg does wring suspense out of getting, he gives us almost every one of the votes. We see the faces. And to speak to your point about characters, Adam, we know what's going on in the minds of the majority of those people who are voting.
Mm-hmm.
When the camera focuses in on them because of all these conversations we've had, we understand what we're thinking. And we understand that for some of them, this is just, should I take the bribe or not? For some of them, it's deeply seated conflicting loyalties. For some of them, it's because they're truly wrestling with this idea of slavery for the first time. I think that is a fantastic sequence that works. Another thing I never would have expected to have gone to a movie about this legislative process and have found it thrilling. And it really did work for me that way.
How can I hold that all men are created equal when here before me stands stinking the moral carcass of the gentleman from Ohio? Proof that some men are inferior, endowed by their maker with dim wits, impermeable to reason, with cold, pallid slime in their veins instead of hot red blood. You are more reptile than man, George. So low and flat that the foot of man is incapable of crushing you.
How dare you?
I agree with you there. There's legitimate suspense in the vote sequence, and that's one of the main reasons, probably the biggest reason, along with Daniel Day-Lewis's performance, that this movie wasn't a total failure for me. And actually, I would go see it again, mainly for those two reasons. I don't want to belabor the opening scene, but I do want to comment on it in the sense that one of the things I liked about it, beyond what you touched on, Michael, with Daniel Day-Lewis's performance just in that scene and the way we see Lincoln, that was really important to set up the film, I think, because it shows him in a way that we don't think about this grand figure. And I really like how there's just a sheer shock factor from watching a president engage with anybody, soldiers, whoever, common people, in that kind of direct, informal way, something that we just would never really fathom happening.
It's one of the reasons I love this. I love the opening.
I'm with you there, but I do think that as it goes on, and by the end, as you said, Josh, as he's reciting the Gettysburg Address, the word you used, Michael, was semi-plausible. I would say it really wasn't semi-plausible. It made me think about the criticism that Aaron Sorkin gets all the time, which is that he writes dialogue in a way that nobody in real life talks. And that may be true, but that's what I felt here. The advantage with Sorkin is all the characters are moving so fast and the dialogue's moving so fast that you don't have to dwell on it. Here, Spielberg really wants us to dwell on it, and he draws those scenes out, and they became more and more frustrating for me. Unfortunately, Josh, I don't think it's an isolated incident. I think it was just maybe one of the biggest offenders. There's a legitimate groaner in the dialogue near the end of the film that I want desperately to believe Tony Kushner didn't actually pen, where a character says something along these lines. It's not Lincoln. History is going to view me as the person who only did such and such. That's exactly how that person is viewed by history. And I remember in my theater, a couple of people snickered because, like, yeah, that's exactly how we've come to know that character. Hmm. But nobody talks like that. And the fact is, the movie spent a great deal of time showing us that that character was something more complex and interesting than what we've come to label them as throughout history. Why did it need to hit us over the head with it and tell us in that final moment? I think that those are examples of a larger problem with this film. And
That's a minor line. I mean, that's
it's a minor line, but there are a lot of lines like that for me.
But do you really think that this film has the same kind of inflated quality as something like
inflated in every moment?
Like compared to Amistad or something like that?
It's been too long since I've seen Amistad, but what I remember of it, there is something similar there. I just want to say about the cinematography before we go on to many other aspects about this film. For me, it was as stately and grand and dull as anything I've seen from Steven Spielberg, and especially the lighting. It has these dark, dark shades around the edges and the sepia tones. So every frame looks like a classic photograph or a classic painting hanging at the National Gallery. And you add to it the dialogue and the music. No, it didn't bring it to life, to go back to answer your question. I felt like I was walking.
You know what it also looks like? If you've ever gone to a living history museum and you go into those rooms, they're dark because even in the day, they didn't have the windows that we have now. I mean, the griminess that you're talking about is one of the things I appreciated that lent it exactly that sort of reality.
I think he traps them in history here.
Okay, now I know what you mean. I know there are moments where there are moments that do jump out of me and did the first time and the second time where you have, say, for example, when the amendment passes and you have the kind of moment that you do think, well, here we go. You know, the Spielberg moment where you have all this heavenly white light suddenly pouring through the windows. Now, that's shameless. There are a couple of other moments in the film that kind of frame and kind of memorialize Lincoln as he's making some grand exit or some momentous whatever. But that's I'd say 2 or 3 minutes of that kind of visual strategy out of 150. And that's not for Spielberg. That's pretty good, you know. And I just think here's my thing, especially on the second time through. I think Spielberg has become one of the few reliable veteran American directors that knows how to move a camera, not just frame and light, and work with cinematographers who do the same. The reason I didn't check out of Lincoln, and the reason I was engaged on levels beyond sort of the ideological content or what Kushner was up to as a writer, is that Spielberg knows how to, I think, subtly energize a very dialogue-heavy movie without going crazy with technique. And that's the kind of thing I was worried about going in. I thought, ugh, coming off War Horse, which to me was just like, can I have one moment that doesn't look like it's trying to be the most gorgeous thing ever or the most whatever ever? And that material was basically kind of second-rate material. And here, thank God you have a writer who's, an incredibly eloquent and really witty American writer who's one of the only guys alive who could actually write plausibly the kind of dialogue that makes sense coming out of Abe Lincoln's mouth around the people, around those speeches.
We'll win the war soon. It's inevitable, isn't it?
Well, it ain't won yet. You'll begin your second term with semi-divine stature. Imagine the possibilities peace will bring. Why tarnish your invaluable luster with a battle in the house? It's a rat's nest in there. It's the same gang of talentless hicks and hacks who rejected the amendment 10 months ago. We'll lose.
I like our chances now.
Let's talk about Day-Lewis a little bit, because, Adam, I think that's another example, at least for me, where my expectations were defied in the way this performance could have gone. I really think he and Spielberg are in concert here in trying to produce something that's not a piece of pomposity.
I agree with you.
Because
it's in his
Day
lead
Lewis,
performance. Yeah.
Yes, he could have gone. We know him from his signature roles in something, where he's playing in Gangs of New York, where he's huge, or There Will Be Blood, where he's big. He's volcanic. He could have gone there. I think Michael's right when you're looking at there are moments here and there where you do see that, where he'll make Lincoln angry. But overall,
it's very subtle.
It's a very subtle, restrained performance that is letting us see – we're learning about Lincoln through the politicking he does, the cajoling he does, the way he befriends people. He uses his genuine concern to win them over. And that took me by surprise, too, that we saw a different sort of Daniel Day-Lewis. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's in concert with the rest of the film.
Okay, see, that's where we differ, is that I wish the rest of the film fully supported what we were getting from Day-Lewis's performance. I think that's the most vibrant and alive thing about this film, though I also love some of the ensemble performances. I think the gang of three that helps them procure
fantastic.
This boat.
James Spader,
very funny.
Tim Blake Nelson, John Hawkes,
I mean,
can basically do no wrong.
You couldn't possibly cast those parts better.
No.
And that goes for most of the movie.
I agree. Most everyone
Tommy
is
Tommy Lee Jones, I mean,
here.
I'm like a newly engaged Tommy Lee Jones, a guy who can... Nobody can check out faster and cash the check quicker than Tommy Lee Jones.
A role, though, as Thaddeus Stevens, where he gets to basically berate everyone sarcastically and in sort of a deadpan way, seems written for Tommy Lee Jones. I mean,
absolutely.
He is
I also feel like he's almost playing the Lincoln I feared. I feared that Lincoln might have gone that way, where he was grandstanding all the time. The part, and it fits more the part that Tommy Lee Jones has, so I think it does work for the film. But compared to Daniel Day-Lewis, that's kind of what I feared, that we would get Lincoln that way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And instead, we're getting him in a much more nuanced performance.
My favorite part of this film, where I really felt like it was taking hold and getting some life, was unfortunately about three-fourths of the way through the movie, where Lincoln finally realizes that he's going to have to be more of an active participant in getting this vote. And we actually see him having some of these political conversations with the gang of three and with some of the House members that he's going to have to convince. Those are really great speeches. For the first time in the film, he becomes more of an active leader. That's where I felt like the movie finally started to gain some steam for me. I also want to credit Spielberg and Kushner and Daniel Day-Lewis for how they portrayed him in being someone who spends most of the film. And this is where he's a little passive, but I still thought it was refreshing because it was a little bit of a surprise to me to see Lincoln this way. It went against historically how I view him and maybe many people view him. He spends most of the film listening to people.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the film, Daniel Day-Lewis is sort of hunched over in a chair, taking in a scene. He's one of these characters who you almost forget he's in the room for a little bit. You forget that he's the most important guy in the room until it's time for him to become the most important guy.
And this is everything we know about this guy historically, you know, and I'm hardly a student of Lincoln, but everything we know about that kind of what made so many people skeptical of the guy's political future, just that he's this sort of reticent backwoods hick, and he's got, you know, maybe some street smarts as an Illinois lawyer or whatever. But, you know, he knew how to play.
Mm-hmm.
We knew how to play that card as sort of a humble Midwestern, approach to kind of these political sharks, and he was a political shark himself. I think what you've said, though, does get at the biggest surprise people who like the film and people who don't like the film are finding, that it is not like There Will Be Blood, as you mentioned, Josh. It's not a film dominated by a massive, dominating performance.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln, the film, is really much more of an ensemble piece than people are expecting. And, I mean, everything you see, of course, in terms of the poster image, and you keep hearing how great Day-Lewis is, even if you don't like the movie, blah, blah, blah. It really is a nice, to me, one of the great strengths of it is that Kushner's managed to write two dozen interesting supporting parts, and they're played by people who haven't been this good in years, like Tommy Lee Jones, Jackie Earle Haley playing something different.
Yeah.
Sally Field, very good as Mary Todd. It's just, to me, that's a pleasure.
I just want to add real quick to your point, Michael, that you're right. In fact, in the big celebration scene at the end of the film, the movie that's really the big joyous moment, it's a supporting character that gets the true moment of joy, not our hero.
Yeah, Michael mentions the poster, and that makes me think, I almost feel as if Spielberg had to resist that poster approach, this whole film of going that direction,
mm-hmm.
and the trailer doesn't, the poster certainly doesn't, any of the stills we get, they're all those iconic shots of Lincoln. But I think that you can sense that wrestling, and maybe he loses in the use of the music. He certainly loses for me in that opening scene and towards the end. But overall, I think he wins this battle throughout the majority of the film.
I'm curious, so that you guys really responded to this film visually as much as you did, because not only did the lighting of it and just the overall grandeur of it bother me, but what you talk about, Michael, in terms of Spielberg's ability to make dialogue scenes exciting, to give them some life, There's no doubt that's something he's proven to be very capable of throughout his career. And I know at least one example is going to come up in my top five here at the end of the show. But watching it, I was really struck by how many times we'd have a great, elegant scene, a graceful conversation, the camera moving so fluidly. And then right at the moment where a character said something that was the most dramatic and the most powerful and incendiary, he'd give us this harsh cut right to the close-up of their face. I mean, those are the graceful moments I've come to expect, not those kind of harsh cuts, but we get them here.
Yeah, again, you're describing a movie that I saw in the trailer, but I don't get from the movie itself. I think they cut the trailer for Lincoln to look as kind of old-fashioned and shameless and corny and Spielbergian as possible. And the film simply doesn't deliver that kind of film. You know, what you're describing, Adam, is much closer to what War Horse is guilty of, Amistad, you know, The Color Purple, which is all this insecure, overbearing technique trampling on the story. And I do not get that from Lincoln. I don't. Lincoln, to me, does not feel in the best way. It just doesn't feel like a Spielberg film to me.
All right. Well, we obviously disagree. At least one of us disagrees with you, Michael. Josh is with you, it seems, on Steven Spielberg's latest film, Lincoln. I'd be remiss if
I didn't throw in. Well, he's on the right side of history. Exactly.
He is. Exactly. You both are. I'd be remiss, though, if I didn't take this moment to point out, Josh, that, as you said, with the big roll call scene, we hear so many of the names, and that becomes really suspenseful. I'm sure you guys didn't notice that one of the names mentioned is the namesake of my birthplace and my alma mater, Josiah Grinnell, gets name-checked. He's one of the I votes in Lincoln.
That went right past
me. It went right past
you? Yeah, sorry about that.
I was very proud.
Also, my alma mater was also name-checked in the, when they named off the name Edward University of Minnesota.
I miss him, too.
I did miss that one as well. Lincoln is out now, expanding to more screens this weekend after a limited release last weekend. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. You have to leave it in your best Lincoln voice. You can also find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Massacre Theater is up next. Will it be a Spielberg scene? Is that a trick question? Plus, a sacred cow encounter with Close Encounters of the Third Kind. We'll see if Spielberg's sci-fi classic still holds up today. Stay with us. Once again, we'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors this week, including Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM11.
You also heard us talk about FreshBooks over the past three or four shows. It's the cloud accounting service for small businesses that saves you time and gets you paid faster. They've got a new iPhone app so you can track expenses and turn hours into invoices on the go. Your clients can view invoices online and pay you right on the spot with a credit card. You can turn timesheets instantly into invoices and run all kinds of great reports to monitor your small business and make sure you're 100% organized so your accountant is happy and you're happy at tax time.
FreshBooks lets you try their service for free. Join the 5 million users that have been sending and paying invoices at FreshBooks.com. Sign up now for 30 days of unlimited use. And be sure to tell them that you heard about it from Film Spotting when asked during sign up. We thank FreshBooks for their support.
What's this I hear about you just getting out?
From the loony bin!
If I
I thought you said you had it together. You were solid.
I am solid. I was solid at the game.
I don't know where I belong.
Hey!
Oh, what the hell?
I just want us to be friends.
So how did you lose your job?
By having sex with everybody in the office.
Everybody?
I was very depressed after Tommy died.
We don't have to talk about it.
Thanks.
How many were there?
Don't let Tiffany get you in trouble.
She's my friend. Why would you say that? I belong
with you. There's this dance thing. I can only do it if I have a partner.
Oh, I'm not gonna dance with you.
So is this the girl you wrote about?
You wrote about me?
She's fine.
She is my friend with an F.
A capital F.
She's fine. For a friend.
Let me tell you, you gotta pay attention to signs. When life reaches out with a moment like this, it's a sin if you don't reach back. I'm telling you, it's a sin if you don't reach back.
This is what I believe to be true. You have to do everything you can. You have to work your hardest. If you stay positive, you have a shot at a silver lining.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson and Michael Phillips. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's the trailer for the David O. Russell film that opens this weekend here in Chicago and in select cities, Silver Linings Playbook. It's a movie I know, Michael, you've probably seen at this point and can tell me if I'm wrong in my enthusiasm, but based on the trailer, it might just be the Lumineer song that I like so much that scores the trailer, but I'm really looking forward to this movie.
It's that manipulative music
it
again
is,
that you
music,
hated in Lincoln.
Me,
now
though.
It's working, huh?
Well, we're going to...
You're a moody fellow.
I am. We're going to gauge your thoughts on Silver Linings Playbook, specifically its director, David O. Russell, as we get to our poll question a little bit later in this segment. But first, it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a famous screenplay and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, Josh and I massacred this scene.
Through. I quit, John.
All right, quit. Nobody's trying to stop you. If you want to quit, quit. Go on back to the bottle. Get drunk. One thing, though. Somebody throws a dollar in a spittoon. Don't expect me to do something about it. Just get down on your knees and go after it.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, don't get it done, dude. That's the second time you hit me. Don't ever do it again.
That's John Wayne as John T. Chance and Dean Martin as the dude from 1959's Rio Bravo, or as we name them in the scene, instead of Chance, he was Lucky. Instead of the dude, he was Lebowski.
Right.
I thought that'd give it away for more people, but unfortunately, there weren't as many entries as I thought. Rio Bravo, of course, directed by the great Howard Hawks, screenplay by Jules Furthman and Lee Brackett.
The tie-in was with our top five list, dramatic performances by comedic actors. So Rio Bravo, of course, was a departure for Dean Martin as the drunk dude. Also had Ricky Nelson in a more serious role than his Ozzie and Harriet sitcom persona.
A few listeners also noted that Dean Martin's old comedy partner, Jerry Lewis, made my top five for the King of Comedy. So another little connection there. If you want to hear that top five dramatic performances by comic actors and my interview with Tim Heidecker about his new film, The Comedy, you can get it at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Josh, as I said, not a ton of entries, but enough for you to reach into that hat and pick out this week's winner. Who is it?
The winner is Caleb Copeland from Columbia, South Carolina.
Congratulations, Caleb. Email feedback at filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
What do I know? I'm lucky to get the part. I know that. I come from Chicago. We do things a little differently out there. We do the play as written. That doesn't go over in New York. Terrific.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent, foreign, and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
I don't know what's about to happen here. As usual, we did not rehearse this scene ahead of time. It
Never
is a
do.
Three-person scene, though I have a very small role. I'm still going to make the best of it. There are no small
you
roles,
usually
right?
Do
just
when
just
you
small
get
performances. Is that the line, Michael?
I've been rehearsing since the early 1980s for this moment.
It's going to be good.
I love it. We're not going to give you
that
any
might
hints.
Predate the movie, actually. There's a hint.
That's true. There's a hint. That's your only hint about this film. Otherwise, I suppose we can tell you it ties in with our topic on this week's show.
There you go.
I'm going to leave it at that. Josh, you started off. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Okay, here we go. And action.
Help me tie this around my waist.
Are you Casper the Friendly Ghost?
I'm sorry. I guess I just can't work.
I guess we are.
I can't work under these.
We're
going to
do this again. Right. And action.
Wow.
Help me tie this around my waist.
What are you doing?
I'm going in after
her. She won't come to you. Let me go.
You've never done this before.
Neither have you.
You're right.
You go.
No. No.
Wait, sorry. Sorry. I screwed up my one line. Here we go.
No. No. Let me.
You can't. Who's strong enough to stay up here and hold the rope? I love you.
And scene.
Thank you for bringing that to a quick close there at the end.
You're not going to go for any melodrama there.
Just like,
I
want this to be done.
I love you.
If you know what film we just brutally massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net.
I feel like there are facets and nuances we may have missed.
No, I think I got it all.
Yeah. Your deadline is Tuesday, November 27th. You have a little bit of extra time to get in your entry, so you can scour Google, do whatever you need to do to make sense of what
we just did. I got to say, too, there's nothing to this acting thing. I don't know why people talk about that. It's so hard.
Easy,
and it's so tough to be a good actor. And you know,
we do make it look easy.
Yeah.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
How fast are they?
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles an hour.
T-Rex?
Mm-hmm.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh. Say again. We have a T-Rex.
Put your head between your knees.
Dr. Grant. My dear Dr. Sattler. Welcome to Jurassic Park.
A scene there from Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park, a film that was not included, much to the chagrin of many Film Spotting listeners, in the options we gave you last week on the show as we posed the Film Spotting poll question, what's your favorite Steven Spielberg film? We couldn't list them all. He's got a lot of very good films. Here are the choices we gave you. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T., Jaws, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List, or was it some other Spielberg film? Michael, I'm going to let you read the results. How did it shake out?
Well, let's take a look, shall we? Schindler's List, 7.25%. Saving Private Ryan, 7.5%. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 7.75%.
I just want to note that Nate Silver from the 538 blog processed all these results this week. That's why there's actually decimal points.
Is that how we got the 2.5? I was wondering. I'd never seen that before.
Because
so you got to believe it.
It was that close.
It was that close.
Those three films at the bottom there were neck and neck all week, and that's how it finally came out.
And then E.T. comes in with 9%. Other, 12.5. Boy, that would include everything from Always to Duel.
It could.
Whatever. Jaws, 26%, and the number one. The number one.
Your favorite.
Predictable number one. You know, the nationally sanctioned number one Spielberg film, Raiders of the Lost Ark, 30%. The film that his own biographer called a soulless and impersonal film, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Wow.
Did you like that film, Adam?
Yeah, I did.
You had a good time with that?
A film.
Josh, big fan of that?
I did, but more importantly, hasn't this poll convince you to retract your opinion on it? I mean, 30% of Film Spotting listeners like Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Almost a third.
And we had almost
1,000 votes. That's a pretty good sample size.
You know, I always bow to the majority. So yeah, sure. Fine. Full retraction.
Well, it is worth noting. I think we noted this when we set up the poll last week, Josh, that we phrased it deliberately, your favorite Spielberg film,
right?
Not the best Spielberg film.
Right, like Schindler's List, tough to really
call your favorite.
The word favorite to.
And yet, 7.25 did go that way. I would probably say, if I was answering the question, what's the best Spielberg film, I'd probably say Jaws. But if I'm going with my favorite, I'm going Raiders.
Raiders. Yeah. I'm going to stick with E.T. Yeah,
okay.
E.T. And I'm a little distressed. Only 9%. Is that a generational thing?
A lot of people on Twitter, as they saw that, were commenting about that E.T. of all films was really coming in near the bottom. I'm a little surprised as well. But then again, when you've got two heavyweights like Jaws and Raiders battling it out for the top spot, that kind of makes sense. In terms of other...
The soulless and impersonal Raiders.
You were able to write in your option. Jurassic Park was the most popular write-in option, followed by Empire of the Sun, Minority Report, Munich, and Catch Me If You Can. Those were all kind of bunched together with a similar number of votes. But Jurassic Park was the runaway other option. Maybe not a surprise there. We appreciate everyone who voted in that poll. Hopefully you'll go to filmspotting.net this week and participate in this week's poll question. As mentioned earlier in the segment, Silver Linings Playbook is out this weekend, the new film from David O. Russell. Another film out this weekend is Joe Wright's Anna Karenina. And that got us thinking, which of those two filmmakers, who if you look at the films they've made so far, are kind of similar? They've both made some mainstream movies. They both made some art house movies. Which director is the bigger draw for you? So I guess the way I'm framing this question, Josh and Michael, is you walk into a theater. There are two doors to go into. You know nothing about the films except one says Joe Wright and one says David O. Russell. Which one do you go into? That's the question. Michael.
Hmm. Which of the two? You know, I like David O. Russell better overall, although I think Joe Wright actually is underrated just in terms of his camera sense. I like mm-hmm. Pride and Prejudice, and I like the first half particularly of Atonement. I'm not less keen on the new one, you know, Anna Karenina, but we'll talk about that some other time.
We will. Josh?
David O. Russell is the wild card, so I've got to go there. I feel like I don't know what's waiting for me beyond those doors, and not that Joe Wright does the same thing every time, but I feel like I have a better idea of what to expect in terms of story and visually, too. And
yeah.
David O. Russell could just go anywhere, so I'd be up for that.
Yeah, it's really tough because the way I tried to think about it was which of the two filmmakers has made the best film. And they've both made films I would possibly throw out the M-word masterpiece for.
Whoa.
I love Atonement, and I just got a little electroshock for saying
that,
actually.
Yeah, that's not allowed.
But I love Atonement, and I love Three Kings that much. So they've both made amazing
films.
High praise
for Three Kings.
Yeah, I think it's that good. So I'm not sure, but in the end, I decided if I really had to walk in that door, I think I'd go Joe Wright, mainly just on the strength of Atonement. But I also did like Pride and Prejudice. I thought Hannah was a very interesting film. So based on that, I will go Joe Wright. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net, and you'll find out what we think of those films in a couple weeks here on the show as we get to a Film Spotting Roundup where we'll devote a few minutes to both Silver Linings Playbook and Anna Karenina.
Est-ce qu'il vous arrive d'entendre des sons curieux dans votre oreille, des sons persistants?
Have you been hearing a persistent ringing in your ears?
Presque agréable, mélodique.
An agreeable ringing.
No. Avez-vous des maux de tête, des migraines?
You having headaches, migraines?
Yeah. Irritation des yeux et du sinus?
An irritation in your eyes and your sinuses?
Yeah. Des démangeaisons, des allergies?
Do you have hives? Do you have allergies?
Des brûlures sur le visage et sur le corps?
You're burning on your face and on your body?
Yes. Who are you people?
Look at this.
Yeah, I got one just like in my living room. Who are you people?
Monsieur Neri, please, one more question. N'avez-vous pas fait récemment une rencontre?
Have you recently had a close encounter?
Une rencontre plutôt inhabituelle?
A close encounter with something very unusual.
Who are you people?
That's Richard Dreyfuss as Roy Neri being interrogated by none other than Francois Truffaut and his interpreter, played in that scene by Bob Balaban, from 1977's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's the fifth Film Spotting Sacred Cow discussion following films such as Pulp Fiction, To Kill a Mockingbird, and The Shining. It's kind of fun to look at a classic film with fresh eyes again, and we thought this made perfect sense, not only being a show devoted to Steven Spielberg, but also this month does mark 35 years since Close Encounters of the Third Kind hit theaters. And Michael, I do have to start before I get too far down my setup path here. Don't you actually have to recuse yourself from this discussion since you co-produced the movie? It says it right there, Julia and Michael Phillips.
That's right. It might be a different one. I actually don't recall. I was taken.
It's another alien abduction.
The memory was scrubbed and I returned actually at the same salary. So no, I can't be the same guy.
Well, I was hoping you'd have some real insights based on your production history with this movie, but Close Encounters was Spielberg's follow-up to Jaws, and like Jaws, it was a huge hit at the box office, raking in more than $337 million on just a $20 million budget. It was a passion project for Spielberg. He wrote the script, though it went through several iterations with several hands helping to shape it, and he described the movie not as science fiction, but science speculation. The 30-year-old director believed then, anyway, that UFOs and alien beings were most likely real, or at least a possibility. Michael and Josh, I'm curious what you think it was in particular that so attracted audiences to this movie. Could they relate to the story of Dreyfuss's small-town Indiana electric lineman who has a run-in with an alien craft and becomes obsessed, at the expense of his wife and kids, with journeying to a potential contact point at Devil's Tower in Wyoming? Or were they just wowed by the grandeur of the special effects? Or maybe they responded to the film's atypically peaceful view of the visitors? I want to start, though, by offering up a villain for our conversation. A villain other than you, Michael Phillips. The role you typically play in these sacred cow discussions. Arit in Los Angeles wrote in. He said, in anticipation of your discussion, I'd like to chime in on what I think to be the most overrated film ever. After viewing Close Encounters for the first time about a year ago, I was perplexed by how this film about a dopey, vapid man who abandons his family to pursue a mountain resembling his mound of mashed potatoes could be considered one of the great sci-fi films of all time. The spectacle and craftsmanship are faultless, but they are used in the service of hokey Hollywood mysticism at its most infantile. I was surprised to hear that this film was an influence on Take Shelter, considering how Spielberg treats the family drama in Close Encounters as a complete afterthought. In Spielberg's world, the return to a childlike sense of wonder and innocence takes precedence to any form of adult responsibility. Art goes on to actually quote a passage from A Cinema of Loneliness, where author Robert Kolker compares Spielberg's strategies in Close Encounters as, quote, precisely analogous to those employed by Leni Riefenstahl in Triumph of the Will.
Ooh.
So, Michael, as I've hinted at here, you've played the villain role in our Sacred Cow discussions largely up to this point. They're all movies that, let's just say, you haven't been passionately positive about. One listener went so far, Ted Abernathy in North Carolina, to suggest that your nickname should be Rain Man for raining on all of our best memories. It would only be fitting, then, for you to validate Art's reaction and rain on everyone who so adores Close Encounters, or will you gasp, hold up this cow as indeed sacred?
I love this film.
Okay.
And it's one of my two or three favorite Spielberg films. It's also, it's really more the opposite, though, Adam. I think now it's more common to find people dismissive of Close Encounters or don't have any relationship to it, didn't grow up with it, whatever their age. And I guess I can't argue with anybody who says, yeah, the portrait of Roy Neary, played by Richard Dreyfuss, is a self-centered, obsessive, distracted, you know, quote, family man who's, you know, perfectly happy to kind of ditch it all in pursuit of, you know, whatever's up there in the skies. And I don't find his behavior particularly sympathetic even. I find it fascinating, though. And I guess I think the later film, E.T., is in many ways a much more polished and it's a little less ungainly. Close Encounters has a lot of kind of strange kind of cul-de-sacs and dead ends in the story where you don't really know what's going on with Neary's obsession. E.T.'s eclipsed Close Encounters in almost every way. It was a bigger hit even. It was far more universally beloved. It was more conventionally heart-yanking.
Yeah, it's more emotional.
Yeah.
It's more sentimental.
And yet, as we'll find out later, I find the last 20, 25 minutes of Close Encounters to be uniquely stirring in science fiction cinema of any era. And I just think that's the kind of blend of technological breakthrough in terms of what's going on with, what, you know, just the depiction of these spacecraft and the creatures from outer space, and just to actually retain an element of mystery in what we're shown. In addition to, as you say, Adam, you know, this completely joyously optimistic view of, well, if they come, maybe in the best possible world, you know, as Voltaire said, you know, what might we get out of this? And I'm really, you know, partly you guys, you know this. I mean, anytime you talk about a movie, you're reviewing your own life at the time you first saw it. If you really fell for it, and that's the reason everybody's got, you know, this insane relationship to Raiders of the Lost Ark, because they saw it at a vulnerable age and they'd never seen a movie that worked, you know, worked them over in that way, and that they could so easily re-see and get something out of. Close Encounters is different because it's not that easy a revisit, I think, because it is a long, sort of blobby movie. But I saw it when I was 16 and I was just completely floored by it. So I still am.
I think the key to the way the movie works is what you mentioned at the beginning, Adam. Spielberg's belief, whatever it might have been, or the possibility of UFOs, is there on the screen. That's what this movie absolutely throbs with and makes it so fascinating to watch, even if you don't agree with everything Roy Neary is doing in relation to his family. But there's a distinction there. There's so much time spent with that family early on that the film cares about the family. So there are two things going on. Roy clearly tosses them aside in favor of whatever's up in the skies, but the movie isn't so eager to do that. So it gives them their time, it gives them their due, and they haunt the rest of the film. That's why it's a sticking point for audiences. They come away and say, yeah, but why would you like that movie? Look what the guy does to his family. It's because the movie paid attention to the family. But what it's focusing on is the wonder. And that's always been the source of Spielberg's best films, is this idea of wonder. And when someone mentions Leni Riefenstahl, I think more of this movie being about triumph of the wonder. In the end, that is what overtakes everything. It's all-encompassing, even to the point that this main character, who is not at all like a traditional sympathetic main character, will give up his life to just see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also really like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, so it's 3 for 3 here. This is a first, I think, in our Sacred Cow discussions. In Arit's defense, our listener who doesn't like this film, I will say that watching it this time, it did really occur to me that it's a movie about a profound experience that deals with really big questions that doesn't really ever at all try to say anything profound or get us to wrestle with those big questions. I think that Pauline Kael said about this film that it was a kid's film in the best sense of the word or something along those lines. She might be right. I was having a little bit of a hard time connecting to the film beyond just basking in the word you use, Michael, the mystery of it. And how amazing I thought it was just watching some of those scenes, the first encounters, Roy's encounter, the little boy, all those sequences, and especially the last 20 minutes or so, I was really drawn into those scenes, Riefenstahl-esque or not, when that mothership comes down and they're communicating with each other via that five-note musical sequence. It's an absolute blast. And I didn't really struggle with Roy's decision to leave the family much, to be honest, even though Spielberg has said later that if he had it to do all over again, he wouldn't have made the film or would have changed it, because after he had kids, he could never make a movie about a father who leaves
and
the
I
kids.
And I think that would have been a weakness, actually.
I do, too.
I
yeah.
do wanna,
it kind of makes me just, it kind of makes me resent that he says that,
He's funny, though. He's very mercurial that way, because Spielberg is a constant reviser that
sure.
way.
He'll
you know how he's noodled with, with the ending of the, quote, special edition of Close Encounters, which, you know, remember that kind of boondoggle where they re-released it and said, finally, you get to see what's inside. Well, the extra 2 minutes of footage or whatever it was A, it undercut the mystery aspect, which is like, well, I wonder what's in there. You don't need to know.
No.
You don't need to see. And that ending is perfect the way it is. But Spielberg's always been one to kind of go back and say, yeah, you know, you're right. They shouldn't be waving guns at the kids on the bikes in E.T. just before they fly. We'll
right.
just change them to walkie-talkie.
Which was a sad change.
No, a dubious change, yeah.
But, you know, it gets back to what you said, Michael, at the start of this conversation about film critics having different relationships with films as we encounter them. Spielberg has different relationships to his own films as he goes on.
You have to appreciate the looseness that an artist like that has towards his own material.
On some
Most
level,
artists
yeah.
don't. I mean, as someone who loves a lot of his films, I don't appreciate it because I want him to stay that way, but that's a rare quality.
I think that the reason Roy's decision didn't bother me that much is because it seemed pretty clear to me anyway, at least midway through the movie. I don't know so much about the end. We can really debate what struggle he's having or not having in this big dramatic moment at the end of the film when the ship comes down. But I was definitely aware of the fact that he doesn't seem to be acting on his own will. He's someone who's had a religious experience, something that has completely changed him forever. He's essentially been reprogrammed. You can't just go to UFOs Anonymous and get cured for your obsession or your addiction to this vision in your head. So I kind of feel like he is someone acting not on his own free will, and we have to give him some room within that and maybe not judge him too harshly. Where the film did finally connect with me, though, is in that interrogation scene, the one where he's talking to Truffaut and Balaban, because, as I said, I felt like it wasn't really dealing with anything overly profound, and I'm still not sure it is, but I love what he says to them. He says, I want answers. Richard Dreyfuss stands up and he says, I want answers, and he says to them, I just want to know that it's really happening. And that is almost a recall of the mashed potato scene where he says to his wife, this is important. This means something. I love that line. I love the, I just want to know that it's really happening. I love that line because it suggests something immediate and practical. In that moment, he's saying, I want to know that this quest I'm on means something, that I'm going to be validated. But I think it also suggests something bigger and more abstract. I want to know that something truly extraordinary, something completely outside our realm of possibility, is really possible. And I think when he says, I want answers, it's not just the lament of a man who is being held prisoner in that sequence. He's not just saying to them, I want answers from you. It's the lament of all mankind. Why are we here? What is our purpose? It's this larger question that, for me, that scene really gets at the heart of the film.
So to Josh's point, I think one thing I had forgotten, and when I resaw it again recently, and didn't see the whole thing with my son, but you know, it's hard for me to inflict my movie going taste on someone who's about to turn 12, you know, because he's developed too many opinions of his own.
Sure.
I try to stamp them out, but there they are, you know. But that particular family scene I'm thinking of, the dinner See, where Roy, the father, really does seem to be truly losing his mind.
And he breaks down.
And it's a pretty anguished scene. And the is I don't know if it's the, is it the oldest son?
I think it is.
Who sits there
starts
and
crying.
Starts crying, and it's a very simply staged and very kind of direct hit on the audience's perceptions of what's happening.
Well, I guess you've noticed something that's a little strange with Dad. It's okay, though. Dad, I can't describe it, what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking. This means something. This is important.
That, to me, proves that Spielberg, even then, the relatively youthful Spielberg, knew how to at least look at Roy from more than one angle. And it makes the movie hold together, even though the movie, frankly, it is sort of a weirdly structured and sometimes kind of a oddly leisurely examination of this one guy who may or may not be can't trust his own psyche really and what's going on. But it's really sort of, I don't know. I've always preferred this movie to E.T. I always have. And maybe if I'd seen E.T. when I was 15 or 16, I'd feel differently. But I just don't have the same direct relationship to E.T. as I do with Close Encounters. It was the first time I'd ever had seen sights like that in a movie. You know?
So then you can understand my attraction to Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah,
and you need to stop writing it.
Have I mentioned this, that Spielberg's biographer actually called Raiders a soulless and impersonal
film? And we can't take the nostalgic defense too far either, because I think both of us, Adam, you and I both made arguments that Raiders stands up outside of the nostalgia. And so that's a good question to ask here. Clearly, Close Encounters stands up for you on revisits, Michael.
For me, but
it's
not a quote as well made and as tidily constructed a story as Raiders is telling or as E.T. is telling. There's no question about it.
Sure.
No question about it. And it's for the same reason that, well, Jaws is also a model of efficiency in one way, but Jaws has kind of a scruffy edge to it. You know, it's not real neat and polished. And you can tell that was sort of a troubled shoot watching. But I that's the other Spielberg film of that time that I adore.
This may be what you're getting at with Raiders, and I'll bring it back to Close Encounters. Jaws and Raiders are much more putting the audience through the machine. We're not in the machine quite as much.
Not Jaws.
Encounters.
I don't agree with that, Josh. I think Jaws and Raiders have completely different temperaments.
But in terms of each scene being calibrated to get a certain effect out of the audiences, Close Encounters is much more open and allowing us to bring what we want to it. And that's why I want to reconsider the question you mentioned at the start, Adam. What did attract audiences to this movie? Was it just Spielberg's persona at that point coming off of Jaws, where everyone's just going to go see whatever he did? Was it because it was the same year as Star Wars? I don't know the timeline, if Star Wars had come out later.
No, that was summer, and then this was November. Yeah.
So was it just kind of, this was in the air, this sci-fi stuff? Because when I look at this film independently of its time of release, I do wonder, as good as I think it is, why was it such a popular hit? Because it is ungainly in those ways you've mentioned, Michael, narratively. And the last 20 minutes, I mean, as much as I like them, you're essentially asking a pop audience to sit through a slightly different version of 2001, a slightly more approachable version of 2001.
Well,
and I'm
more
just
than
really,
slightly.
I agree with that.
I'm just really surprised, though.
Yeah.
Even so, that it goes on that long that mainstream audiences did embrace it to the level
that
they did.
Without spoon-feeding you really any information. You have
not
to follow
you a
along
payoff,
and play along.
And the payoff that you get, I think, leaves people quite disgruntled in a lot of ways because of the family aspect. So it's not this sort of Spielbergian experience, even though it has all the lights, it has all the things we think of. In essence, it's really opening up to the audience in ways he usually doesn't do, and it's encouraging to me that the audience still embraced that.
Yeah, I mean, Star Wars, when that came out, that was it didn't have the same – Close Encounters didn't – even though it was a big hit, it didn't have the same popular impact on, like, my peer group. You know, if you want to look at the numbers, there's no comparison. I mean, Star Wars is a much bigger influence, you know, financially and the rest of it. I also think Star Wars as a piece of – movie making can't hold a candle to the best Spielberg films. It just can't. It's just, I mean, it's God knows it hit a popular chord. And I saw that film four times, you know. And everybody, the minute they saw the jump, the hyperspace jump in Star Wars, they knew they were going to see it again. Now, I think that maybe that relates to, and now, of course, that effect looks, you know, because we've seen it 1,000 times since. In closing, what's the key thing that even someone like James Cameron was talking about with Avatar? You know, what's the key to getting people interested? You know, show them something they haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. Now, people hadn't seen UFOs depicted in anything like you saw in Close Encounters. And that film, like Star Wars, Close Encounters was essentially made, its future, its impact was made in post-production, in the effects stage. And the moment when the mothership came over the mountain was, I had not had anything like that in my movie-going experience, maybe 2001 in a much darker, mm-hmm. you know, more unsettling vein. But it's hard to tell audiences today the impact that single shot had. And that was also a gorgeous moment of John Williams' music.
Yeah, you know? It is.
You know, it's, but can you recreate it? Can you show a 2012 audience that film and expect the same reaction and tell them, well, don't worry about some of these scenes, they get a little long and you might find yourself a little antsy? I mean, the film works on its own rhythm, and man, it just doesn't seem to belong to the world we know now, does it, Josh? I mean,
no, it doesn't at all, but it still works. And that's the distinction where we compare, like, Raiders, the action in Raiders, which you've talked about being chaotic, yet when you look at the action films we get now where it's pure chaos. And I think Close Encounters work similarly, where this unique sense of wonder that Spielberg is able to capture in those scenes, in those final 20 minutes, we don't, no matter how many special effects we have, I don't think we still get that whole package. We get the technology, but we don't get the wonder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it is fair to say a technical triumph, and we have to single out, while we're talking about it, Douglas Trumbull and Carlo Rambaldi and Vilmos Zsigmond, the cinematographer, and John Williams, you mentioned on the score. I mean, everyone who had a technical role in this film really was at the top of their games, I think. And specifically, Michael, as you said, when mentioning that this is something you had never seen before, audiences never seen it, they literally had never seen before those kind of effect shots, mm-hmm. where you have a UFO, where you've got these spaceships, and you've got a moving camera. Mm-hmm. Before, they had to clamp it down so that they could do the special effects in post-production. Here, they were able to rig the technology, I believe, for the first time, where you actually could have that camera still moving. Imagine seeing the last 20 minutes of this film without having the fluidity and that elegance of Spielberg's camera as we see that mothership come down and as we see them communicate. It would be a completely different film. Obviously, we are all in agreement on enjoying Close Encounters of the Third Kind. This was a nice change of pace.
The cow is still sacred.
The cow is indeed still sacred. As I mentioned, this is our fifth such discussion. We don't have a sixth scheduled yet, but we like to do this every 2 or 3 months. We probably won't get to another one until after the first of the year.
And it probably won't be Spielberg.
No,
right?
And it will not be Spielberg after Raiders and Close Encounters. But sometime after the first of the year, we will get to another one. We don't have an idea set in stone yet. So if you've got a good idea for a film that you think there's a compelling reason to revisit, we look forward to your ideas. You can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Guys, we're going to need a bigger list. Adam, Michael, and I try to select the best scenes from Steven Spielberg's filmography next in the Film Spotting Top 5. Stay with us. Thank you.
Well, after saying such horrible things about John Williams in the Lincoln Review, we can play him redeeming himself there with the great score from Catch Me If You Can. I love the score, and especially that theme from Catch Me If You Can, as we are featuring some of our favorite John Williams compositions in our breaks this week. And we're going to get to donations and our thank yous here in a moment, but did want to share a couple notes. First of all, I know there are a lot of Film Spotting listeners out there who are also This American Life fans. I'm one of those This American Life fans, and you probably heard their live show in May called The Invisible Made Visible. They're offering that as a direct download for $5. They're using the Louis C.K. model. It was just made available this past Thursday. So if that's a show you're inclined to check out, maybe you don't know This American Life, this would probably be a fairly decent show to start with. And you can get that at live.thisamericanlife.org. So I wanted to share that note, as we are big fans of This American Life. Also got this email from a listener who's calling himself Alan the Abominable. He says, I hope you'll indulge this longtime listener. Since episode 10, I'm trying to organize a film spotting meetup in Bristol or Bath in England sometime in November for the UK release of The Master. I don't have a precise date or venue yet, but as soon as I do, it will be on the film spotting message boards. If you could mention this on the show, that would be great. It's already there in the Film Spotting Forum. There's a section called Local Events and Meetups, and Alan has posted there. If you're in that area and you're so inclined to check out The Master with other Film Spotting listeners, sounds like a great time. We love encouraging these type of events. They happen all over the world, actually. And those details, again, are in the Film Spotting Forum. We'll put a direct link in our show notes.
Do you want to go? I need to take another look at The Master.
So I do, too. And I haven't been to England since 95, so
let's do it.
I am all for it.
We also heard from Andre Senra. He wrote in and said, I am a longtime Brazilian listener, since it was called Cinecast, and a great fan of your show. Film Spotting is my best friend during the long hours spent in Sao Paulo's heavy traffic. I turn to you now for some help. For some time, I have been looking for a site where I can download, stream movies. I am more than willing to pay some bucks to be able to watch them. I don't want to go to illegal torrent sites. The thing is, all of them seem to work for U.S. citizens only. Vudu, Netflix, Fandor, etc. Whenever I state my address or billing information, they shut me down. I assume it has to do with copyrights and legal agreements between studios and those sites. Are you aware of any site that allows non-Americans to watch movies over the internet?
So maybe a question better posed to our streaming video unit investigators.
Yeah, it sounds like a case for them.
Matt and Allison. But unfortunately, I think Andre might just be out of luck. It does seem, from my experience, that all these sites tend to only cater to U.S.-based users. Sometimes U.S. and Canada, they'll go North America, but I think it really is just U.S.-focused. And the reason I wanted to share his email is, obviously, we have an enthusiastic film fan out there who's trying to get access to more films and hasn't been able to figure out a way to do it yet. And I don't have an answer, but maybe somebody out there does know an answer.
We have a lot of non-U.S. listeners.
Exactly.
So I'm sure someone knows.
So if you have any ideas, email them to feedback@filmspotting.net. We'll make sure that Andre sees your responses. We're going to get to our thank yous, Josh. We have 6 new donors this week, but as always, we want to plug the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, his podcast that features interviews with screenwriters. And this week, he has screenwriter John Gattins on to discuss his new film, Flight.
Also, Backstory issue 03 just launched on the iPad from Jeff. For those James Bond fans out there, this issue is going to feature Skyfall co-writers Neil Purvis and Robert Wade. They'll talk about how they've continued to write Bond films for over a decade. Just type Backstory into the iPad App Store to download the first issue for free for a limited time.
And that does bring us to our new donations. We start with a $5 a month donor, Eric in New York.
I've been listening to Film Spotting for just a little over a year now, so I'm backfilling my support to you guys for that time. As you may expect, I love the show. I'm far from a film expert. I have plenty of classics still on my to-see list, but you guys have such a great mix of analysis and a fan's enthusiasm in your reviews that I feel like I can get smarter every time without feeling embarrassed or out of place listening in to your conversation. Plus, it's great when you disagree, because I always end up being on the winning side, which is usually Josh's.
How dare you?
He actually wrote that, too.
I know he did.
Say that.
Oh, believe me, I would have loved to have omitted that part, but no, I had to get it in there, especially because Eric not only decided to be a new $5 a month donor, but he also threw in on top of that a Silver Club level donation. So, Eric, thank you so much for that. We got this note from another $5 a month new donor, Geraldine in Lilyfield, New South Wales, Australia. That sounds beautiful. I wish I was there, as Chicago is getting more cold and blustery. This is kind of a long note, but I think it goes in some interesting directions, so I wanted to share it.
This donation has been a long time coming, and I'm so glad that I'm finally pulling my finger out and sharing with you how much joy your show has brought into my life.
I'm guessing pulling my finger out might be an Aussie thing.
I was just trying to process that as I read it.
I loved it.
Just go with it. There's a special kind of magic that happens every time I pop in my headphones, fire up the film spotting app, and jog around the beautiful bay near my house. I feel like I'm attending my own private film school. I've managed to muddle my way into becoming a professional actress, and while I mostly do theater, film is a big part of my life. And listening to your podcast has definitely fired up the desire in me to make more movies. Movies like Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, The Tree of Life, and Take Shelter are all films I adored, and it's great to find my thoughts on them articulated so clearly by you guys. I've been thinking recently how great it would be if you did an Australian film marathon. It's often lamented down under that Australians don't have a good appreciation of their own cinema. Having you guys review a mix of classics like Muriel's Wedding, Priscilla Queen of the Desert, Strictly Ballroom, The Man from Snowy River, or Gallipoli, and lesser-known gems like Wake and Fright, Little Fish, Look Both Ways, Cosi, or Wasted on the Young, one that I just happen to be in, might be a great opportunity to give your Australian listeners some much-needed confidence in their own stories. It would also be a good opportunity to try out your best Australian accent for Massacre Theater.
Oh, that could be ugly.
I bet it doesn't differ much from my British or my Scottish.
No, it'll probably be your Italian again.
Italian. Go on, she says. I dare you. Thanks again for so much comic gold and thoughtful discussion.
Well, thank you so much for your donation and those thoughts, Geraldine, and your kind words, of course, about the show. I wanted to include that longer note because she goes that direction of mentioning Australian cinema. And one of our listeners, we have a lot of listeners in Australia. You hear them mentioned every week in donations. A listener recently mentioned how there had been some talk a while back of maybe Australian cinema being a potential marathon topic, but that was no longer on the marathon's page. I don't know if it was ever there. Maybe it should be added. I certainly haven't discounted that idea completely. I think it would be a good one because
it is a
world cinema that I don't feel at all equipped to talk about. That said, it didn't stop me from doing a top five Australian movies list back in 2010. Oh. Michael Phillips was a guest on that show, and I think we talked about that recent Australian film with a great performance from Jackie Weaver. I'm now completely...
Animal Kingdom.
Thank you. Animal Kingdom. I was drawing a blank. We did our top five Australian films. I think I acquitted myself okay in that list, but there
you
are,
still feel a marathon
many,
could be
yeah.
do. Yeah.
Many
I think we'd have to focus it on a certain period, maybe like the 70s perhaps might have been a good time to we could really delve into films
maybe
from
so.
Around then. Yeah,
okay.
That sounds good.
You're right. It's certainly a broad enough cinematic range that just saying Australian cinema,
maybe
six films or five films wouldn't be quite enough for that. We also got a Silver Club donation from Island in Walnut, California.
This is my small way of thanking you for your hard work for every show. It makes my day brighter when I tune into your podcast, laugh the day away, getting odd looks from the cube neighbors, and tune out the project managers who love to say, expedite it. You guys are great.
All I got to say is get back to work right now. Expedite it. I'm going to start using that phrase, I think.
End all your emails to me that way, please.
I love it. We also heard from a Silver Club donor, George Ondahl in Red Wing, Minnesota. He said, thanks again for all the work you put into film spotting. It really is this decade's Siskel and Ebert. Now you're just talking crazy. Also, thank you for the Iranian marathon. He's got two films in his queue.
Very nice.
Our last two donations, Logan in Columbus, Georgia.
I'm making this donation in honor of a local website and podcast called Film Dispenser. They cite film spotting as a major influence, and they've done a lot in the last year to help cultivate a true film community in my city. It's a good podcast run by passionate film lovers. And finally, because of last week's Massacre Theater, when I'd heard that the top five was going to be comedic actors in dramatic roles, I spent the week racking my brain for my own list. It wasn't until I began listening that I realized who my number one would be, Dean Martin as Dude in Rio Bravo.
Logan goes on to say, then you guys murdered one of my all-time favorite scenes, and I loved it. The name changes were brilliant. Lebowski, it had me in stitches, and you guys were as excellently bad as always. Rio Bravo is a film that has meant a great deal to me. It's a movie that my now-departed grandmother loved, and so it became one of my favorites. Watching it always brings back memories of her and time spent in her company. So thank you guys so much. Keep up the great work, and since I only ever send you guys money when you mention one of my favorite films, I'll just email you a list in case the coffers ever dwindle too much.
That's a great idea.
That is a great idea. Our final donation this week comes from a listener who follows us on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @ALRMCoug. He's in Murray, Utah. I'm guessing he's a BYU Cougars fan.
Oh,
that name may come from. And he says simply, this donation is in honor of math and science, which I love. It's an inside joke. It comes from the fact that a few weeks ago on the show, during our Audible recommendations, I plugged the Nate Silver book.
Oh, yeah.
The Signal and the Noise.
Yeah.
I mentioned how he'd become this political lightning rod, and now everyone knows his name after he called all 50 states right and correctly predicted that Obama would win. This listener heard me recommend that book and had to jab me a little bit, had to chide me for showing my partisanship and being political, he accused me of on the show. So we got into a little friendly back and forth, a few sarcastic comments, and he suggested that maybe we should feature a book by a conservative-leaning author.
Oh.
Even though Nate Silver's book isn't political in any way, shape, or form, he suggested that, and I said, no, you know, for me, it's not about politics, it's all about math and science. And he said, well, I just hope that you're still on the side of math and science when Nate Silver's wrong. Well, Nate Silver was right, and this is what you gotta love about our listeners. Even when we can completely disagree, he sends in a note in honor of math and science and shares some of his hard-earned dollars with us. We do really appreciate every cent that we get. Thank you so much, everyone.
Hi, this is Martin McDonagh. You're listening to Film Spotting.
Your movie I just saw again the other day, which is like mind-blowing, and I haven't seen it since it came out, is Munich.
Oh, Munich!
If any of us get late tonight, it's because of Eric Bana.
You're listening to Film Spotting. That's Seth Rogen and pals from Judd Apatow's Knocked Up, extolling the badassness of Eric Bana in Steven Spielberg's Munich. It seemed to me, guys, like an appropriate way to begin our top five Steven Spielberg scenes. We're actually going to try to do something a little bit different. We're going to group our picks two at a time. And the question I want to pose to each of you, as you give us your first two choices, Michael, is how much did nostalgia, the very thing we just talked about in our conversation about Close Encounters of the Third Kind, how much did that factor in to your choices? Or did it at all? Did you catch yourself falling back on scenes you remembered loving as a younger, less cinematically erudite young man?
Well, first of all, I was always at least this smart.
Of course.
Secondly, I think I resisted picking the kind of grand showcase sequences that Spielberg often, and the stories often support this, but Spielberg has a particular affinity for, where you'll get, even in a relatively minor film like Catch Me If You Can, where you have the extended sequence where DiCaprio, posing as the airline pilot, is sort of swanning his way through the airport with the stewardesses, and it's all scored to Sinatra's and Billy May's version of Come Fly With Me.
Why are you spoiling my number one choice?
That's why I'm here, baby. And, you know, it's shaped like a huge musical number in terms of its scoring and rhythm. It's not a musical number, but that's the kind of impulse it has. Even in a film that doesn't work at all, like 1941, you have this jitterbug scene that devolves into this brawl between Army and Navy, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. And that, too, has this sort of great sort of ta-da, you know, and he's a showman. He's a showman, okay? Nonetheless, I tend to pick smaller, more kind of almost incidental examples of why that guy's a great at his best is just a peerless mixture of showman and almost not accidental artist, but reluctant artist. You know, he's always at war. Spielberg is always at war within himself to be how honest and fearless he needs to be as a filmmaker versus how much he needs to keep the audience's needs foremost in his mind. It's a fascinating struggle. You know, it's sort of the story of cinema writ large in a way. And Spielberg, and I'm very hot and cold on him because I haven't loved a movie of his in a long time. Lincoln is the first one since Minority Report. That's a long time.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the struggle as I see it. I just tend to pick his smaller examples of why I think he's great at his best.
Well, let's hear him.
All right. Now you want number five and four? Mm-hmm. Number five. Here's small, not one of his great films, War of the Worlds, okay? You know, derided in many quarters. The scene I'm thinking of is just about a minute in length where you have these displaced citizens of the Eastern Seaboard. I forget exactly which part of the Eastern Seaboard, which part of the Eastern U.S. we're talking about here, but the first Martian attack has already happened, the first wave, and these people are only now becoming kind of aware of the severity of this attack, and they are sort of walking through this little Harbor Town, and ding, 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 you know, the train signals come down. I think, great, you know, a sign of life. We can catch this train. And then you get this really chilling image of the ghost train on fire. Nobody on it that has been zapped by the Martians, apparently, whizzing through at this insane speed and then gone. And that's just one little fleeting example of the destruction and mayhem being caused by the Martians. And it's not a big scene. It's just, to me, though, it was the one I remember now. And Spielberg's got a lot of those in his career where you just have this kind of a resting moment where it's just enough effects to startle you, and the right kind of digital or further back in his career, old-fashioned optical effects. But it's not just for visual show. But anyway, number four, similar deal, Minority Report, a film I really love of his from 2002. And there's a lot of scenes I love in that. I love anything with jetpacks. I love the jetpack sequence. I love everything with the precog stuff.
Samantha Morton.
Yeah, Samantha Morton in the tank. You know, that's really brilliantly visualized. But I guess if I had to pick one scene from that film, it would be that sort of swarm of spider bots that entered the apartment where Tom Cruise, the lead character, is hiding. And again, that's a wonderful mixture of effects and real action and just brilliantly staged. I love it.
Yeah, I'm much more mixed on Minority Report than you, but I love that scene. It's actually an honorable mention for me. Josh, your picks.
Yeah, I tried to strike a balance between nostalgia. As I mentioned in our Close Encounters review, I want to be able to get past that and justify these movies on their own terms. So I looked at a few scenes that I'm nostalgic about, and if they really held up on their own, then I included them on the list. I also have some others that I came too late, so hopefully it's a nice balance here. I'm going to start with Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it's the overtaking of the truck, where Indy starts out on horseback, and the crowds are cheering him on. I never really understood why they're cheering him on, but it works for the scene. It's the showman in Spielberg, right? So Indy manages to steal the truck without a plan, but as he says, making it up as he goes along. And that's what I love about the entire movie, is how it's so calibrated, yet it has that feel of being improvised, all of the action scenes. And this one really captures the propulsive nature of the entire movie, the entire series, really. And it also takes time for character, which I think is so essential to the Indiana Jones movies. Indy's repeatedly surprised at what he's managed to pull off. He smiles when he pulls it off. He's also scared and looks scared, which adds to that vulnerability that the character had. And there's that great touch, I think you mentioned it, Adam, in our Raiders review, where he shares a grin with the Nazi he's fighting when the villager falls on the windshield and pulls a frightened face, and they both kind of look at each other and grin. Then, of course, it climaxes with Indy getting thrown through the front window, goes under the truck, and still makes it back on top. It's just the idea that here's this approachable hero who seems vulnerable, yet he also has the invincibility of a superhero. So great action scene, and so important in developing the character, too. Number four, Michael, you stole my thunder a little bit on this one. Potatoes scene from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. When I watched this again recently, it became the scene of the movie for me. It really did, for some of the reasons you mentioned. And I think it's key that Spielberg has grounded this story and so many of his fantastic stories in something as mundane as the family. In a lot of these sci-fi stories, we get the military's perspective or the president's perspective or something like that. But in Spielberg, they're always family stories. And Close Encounters is dedicated to the Neary family. We've got the three screaming kids. We see how messy this house is. Terry Geir's crazed mom and this dazed dad who's really like a fourth kid. That's kind of the impression we get of him. And this dinner scene is their attempt at normalcy. And they achieve it. They seem to have gotten a quiet moment, a family dinner together, until the mashed potatoes come out. And at first, it's funny. You see Terry Geir's face when he starts sculpting, like, I can't believe he's doing this. And then it takes that really tragic turn with the kid's tear that you talked about, Michael. Yeah. And his admission when he says, I guess you've noticed something a little strange with Dad. The movie really hits another level there. And so in this one scene, very static scene, we get so many notes of humor, sadness. The mystery that we talked about with that film is still there, too. And as great as the light show at the end of the movie is, I had seen variations on that before, as I mentioned in 2001. but very few sci-fi films have allowed the wonder to kind of intrude on everydayness the way Close Encounters does.
Well, I'm going to pick up your thread with the family. We'll probably come up more than once in some of our top five lists as we're sharing our top five Steven Spielberg scenes. But first, I do want to note that if this top five list sounds at all familiar to longtime Film Spotting listeners, last December, around Christmas, Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore, our hosts from Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit, sat in on Film Spotting and talked about War Horse, and they shared their top five Spielberg scenes. So we'll link to their list in the show notes at filmspotting.net. As to the question of nostalgia that I posed to you, I was really surprised in finishing my list how little it factored in for me. In fact, I'm sure I'm going to get some haranguing emails from listeners who can't believe some of the big tentpole great Spielberg films that I've been on record about loving that I overlooked here for this list. But in the end, these were the five that really did emerge as my favorites. And my number five is the scene from Catch Me If You Can. It's the Christmas Eve call between Frank and Carl. DiCaprio's character, the criminal, the counterfeiter who calls Tom Hanks, the FBI agent who's at the office late at night on Christmas Eve.
Do you always work on Christmas Eve, Carl?
I volunteered so men with families could go home early.
Looked like you were wearing a wedding ring out in Los Angeles. I thought maybe you had a family.
No, no family. You want to talk to me? Let's talk face to face.
All right. I'm at my suite at the Stuyvesant Arms, room 3113. In the morning, I leave for Las Vegas for the weekend.
You think you're going to get me again?
Tom Hanks' sketchy Boston accent aside, I love that scene because he says he's calling to apologize for giving him the slip and making him look foolish when he slipped through Carl's fingers. But it all sets up to be this kind of classic crime movie cat and mouse scene where the criminal calls to taunt the cop who's trying to catch him. They're going to do some verbal sparring. Maybe it will tell us something we didn't already know about the characters. Maybe it won't. More likely, it's there to help push the plot forward in some way. We think that's what's happening with this scene. And as you watch it, it definitely seems like DiCaprio's character is in complete control. He's talking slowly and with purpose. He seems to be really driving the conversation, and Carl is excitable and flustered. And then the tables turn.
I'll tell you what I am sure of. You're going to get caught. One way or another. It's a mathematical fact. It's like Vegas. The house always wins.
Sorry, but I have to go.
You didn't call just to apologize, did you?
What do you mean?
You have no one else to call.
He figures out that DiCaprio called him for no other reason than he has no one else to call on Christmas Eve. This is just a sad, lonely boy. And Spielberg does cut to a close-up there of Tom Hanks' lips that just emphasizes the fact that he's cued on to the fact that this kid is really kind of a fraud in his own way. And like so many characters in the Spielberg universe, he's just looking for a surrogate father. And he's kind of found one in this FBI agent who's trying to get him in Carl.
That conversation is almost as good as most of the ones in Lincoln, so I'll give you that.
How dare you? My number four Spielberg scene is a more well-known, more revered scene. It is one of the best, if not the best, character introductions of all time when we meet Quint, played by Robert Shaw, in Jaws. I love how we only see his hand. We only see his hand on the chalkboard for a brief glimpse, and then we see him briefly as this slow tracking shot begins from the front of the room. So it has to glide by people who are obstructing our view as we're trying to get a clean look at who this crazy guy could possibly be. And it stays on him as it tracks, building this tension, focusing everything on Quint's words and everything on him.
You all know me. Know how I earn a living. I'll catch this bird for you, but it ain't gonna be easy. It's bad fish. Not like going down the pond chasing bluegills or tommy cods. This shark, swallow you whole. Shaking, tenderizing, down you go. And we gotta do it quick. That'll bring back the tourists. That'll put all your businesses on a paying basis. But it's not gonna be pleasant. I value my neck a lot more than $3,000, Chief. I'll fine him for three, but I'll catch him and kill him
for 10. And you gotta make up your minds. You wanna stay alive and ante up? You wanna play it cheap? Be on welfare the whole winter. I don't want no volunteers. I don't want no mates. There's too many captains on this island.
It might be a stretch, but in thinking about it, I saw a parallel a little bit to what Spielberg ends up doing, accidentally or not, with the shark, where we never see the shark for a long time and we kind of have to build it up in our own imagination. He kind of does that with Quint on a much smaller level. And then he cuts to the table with the officials only when he says the chief's name. And they do a little bit of alternating between these slow tracking shots. And then you get this great punchline.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
And the camera stops. The camera cuts to the table and it finally is still. And it just punctuates the scene and adds to a little bit of the humor of the scene. He's very persuasive, but he's clearly a little bit insane and they're speechless. And so I think the camera, like I said, emphasizes that by being still. And he actually says there's too many captains in this town, which reinforces something that's going to come into play in a major way a little bit later in the film. But I love that scene as well, because what we've seen up to that point is really a film about bureaucracy run amok and how it did lead to some lives being lost. And so when he says that, when he says there are too many captains in this town, that's a really pointed moral kind of remark actually in that moment. But like I said, I think it's just really probably one of the best character intros in all of cinema.
Yeah, Spielberg has always been very self-critical, and in interviews right around, actually this is funny, during the making of 1941, he was already panicking in interviews in the press. He was like, I'm no good at comedy. I'm no good at comedy. Now, what he was really saying was, I'm no good at wildly over-budgeted, unfunny slapstick comedy. But he is, what I love about Jaws, and that's my number three, in fact, is a scene from Jaws, different one. The mixture of horror and really wildly funny character based, or just sort of visual psych gag based comedy is completely assured even early in his career. Mm-hmm. And he's got a malicious wit, and it works usually entirely visually, which is a fine way for a movie director to work. So my number three is, you know, a more kind of insidious mixture of sort of a sick black comedy and really, really kind of, you know, nerve shredding suspense. It's the beach scene where Roy Scheider, the chief of police in Amity, knows there's a shark out there. And, you know, he's dealing with a beach that has ill-advisedly been open to the public. And you see waves of people going into the water, and you know, there's a lot of false starts. About you hear a woman screaming, and it's just somebody horsing around. And then, of course, you get the attack on the boy.
Alex Kittner.
Alex, well, you know the name.
I just watched it recently. Rewatched it.
And you just, and in this sort of really artful middle distance shot, you see, you know, this splooge of blood and no more boy. And it's a very crafty and effective suspense sequence. And then you have a shot that, even though it's, again, it's sort of a throwaway moment, but you see the mother of the boy who's gone now forever, just sort of wandering the beach looking for, you know, the one kid that got it.
It's a heartbreaking scene.
Yeah, heartbreaking scene, and it's the reason that movie sticks still is just those little touches like that. My number two comes from the other Spielberg film that I adored as a teenager and I adore still, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's the scene where Roy Neary is in his pickup at the railroad tracks, trying to find, I think he's got a map, and he's trying to find out, you know, what
certain town, I think he's supposed to go to.
What the next town is on the job, and he sees the headlights of the car behind him. He waves him through, the car passes him by, and then there's another set of headlights that comes along a minute or two later, and he waves that by or something, but those headlights just simply rise up because it is, in fact, the UFO. It's a perfect sight gag setup, and then that moment where you get the dump of light. It's just fantastic mixture of humor and suspense, and you kind of can't believe what you're watching. And that's how good the effects were in 1977. You couldn't believe the sights you were seeing. And Spielberg just orchestrated them brilliantly.
They did. They just had to clamp the car down and then turn it over with him strapped in. And that's why you see the loss of gravity. It's such a great special effect. It really is great.
Well, Jaws has already gotten two mentions, so I'll give it a third for my number three. It's actually Show Me the Way to Go Home, the singing of the three on the boat. I love the Indianapolis story that precedes it, but really that's a Robert Shaw scene when you think about it. It's all about his delivery. And what comes next after that is pure Spielberg audience manipulation, which I appreciate. Quint wraps up the Indianapolis story, and there's this awkward silence. Eventually, Hooper starts singing.
Show me the way to go home. I'm tired and I want to go to bed.
Then Quint joins in, and I love the goofy grin he offers as he joins in singing. And he has this surprisingly high pitch we wouldn't expect from this gruff character. It's a really vulnerable moment for him. And what we get here when all three of them come together to sing, they're united for the first time, really. And it's hope. It's this glimmer of hope that, hey, these guys, maybe they're actually going to be able to pull this off. What happens next, though? The buoy pops up. So I just love the transition from this sense of comfort to the terror that we know, yeah. We really know is coming. So the buoy pops up. It's ready to dash that hope. And sure enough, in the midst of the song, we get the shark headbutting the side of the boat as if to say, enough of this. Let's go.
Everybody's a critic.
From that point on, the movie just goes.
Yeah.
Love that scene.
It's a fantastic sequence. You're right, especially if you do include the Indianapolis speech in there. That was one I really wrestled with whether or not to include. It didn't end up making my final five, so I'm sure we're going to get a few emails about that.
Yeah, we definitely need to give it a mention. Now I'm going to jump up ahead from my number two all the way to AI, artificial intelligence, and it's David pleading with the Blue Fairy. So in the future, we have this submerged Coney Island, and the robot boy David, played by Haley Joel Osment, he's seeking out this statue of the Blue Fairy, who he believes is going to turn him into a real boy. What I love about this thread throughout the movie is how much of a commentary it really is on Spielberg's earlier work, how much of those worked as fairy tales of their own. And of course, you know, we have his dabbling with Peter Pan and Hook and When You Wish Upon a Star, his music in Close Encounters. So it's this thread of fairy tale and returning to youth that we have that's brought about in this scene. But it's actually really a depressing scene for Spielberg's films, one of the more depressing ones, because he's sitting inside this submersible vehicle staring at this underwater statue and just repeatedly saying, please, please make me into a real live boy, over and over again. And our understanding is that because he's immortal, this is something like an eternal curse. And the narrator even comes on and says, and David continued to pray. Eventually, the floodlights dimmed and died, but David could still see her. And the narrator goes on to say, the next day and the next day and the next day. It's just so depressing. It's this rare resistance to sentimentality that you don't see a lot in Spielberg. And I think this is where the cold eeriness of Kubrick's involvement, who famously passed the project on to Spielberg. He had wanted to do it quite a bit earlier, but passed it on to him. You can see that coming through. And this is why I really love AI, is because there are so many of these moments where you can see those two influences working together. Now, of course, AI infamously doesn't end here. And while I don't have a problem...
Tragically, it doesn't end there.
I don't have a problem...
Because it's such a beautiful moment. You're right.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, people are really devastated by where it goes. I'm okay with where it goes, but I do think that if it had ended here, it would have been this anti-Spielbergian stroke of genius and possibly made AI his best film.
Well, I'm with you on it being a stroke of genius, but unfortunately it does not end there. My number three Spielberg scene is one that I'm going to glom onto your use of the word terror when you were talking about Jaws. I'm not sure that there's a sequence more terrifying in all of Spielberg's films than this one. It's one of the first scenes I thought to include when we chose this topic. I instinctively tried to come up with a reason not to include it because I thought it was maybe too obvious, too boring a pick, but I just couldn't leave it off. And thankfully, I've got some listener support. Here's Mark to announce my number three.
Hey, Adam and Josh, it's Mark Kearney from Essex Junction, Vermont. With Veterans Day this week, I'm leaving a short message on the D-Day scene in Saving Private Ryan, one of my favorite Spielberg scenes. This scene puts viewers in the place of those servicemen and women, as close as we will and probably ever want to be. Whether you love, hate, or just respect war movies, this scene redefined them. There would be no Band of Brothers from HBO without it, my pick, for best war movie or series. For me, it was just one of those movies where you remember where you were the first time you see it. With this one scene, Spielberg paid his respect for our national heroes by showing instead of telling about their sacrifice. Thanks, and keep up the great work.
Certainly the Omaha Beach sequence from Saving Private Ryan is an appropriate choice, as Mark notes, because of Veterans Day having just passed. And I actually do, like Mark suggested, I remember exactly what theater I was in. I remember what seat I was in the row as I watched that door on the transport boat release and the chaos began, the bullets actually started whizzing by. It took my breath away. You're kind of blindsided by the horror of it, the same way those first few soldiers are when they're shot before they even have a chance of getting off the boat. There's such a calmness and such a stillness to them sort of getting ready, mentally getting ready. And you see a few people throwing up, and you see Tom Hanks's hand shaking a little bit, but it's so still. And then that door falls and just hell begins. And that handheld camera not only puts you right in the line of fire with them, it puts us in the water with some of the bodies. It gets blood spattered on it, of course, and it goes on relentlessly for almost 20 minutes. I actually think about that sequence a lot in the same way I think about a film I don't like quite as much. That's The Passion of the Christ, the Mel Gibson film, where you see Jesus just getting absolutely beaten to a pulp most of that film. It's sort of this idea that I think Gibson has said he was going for, which is, I'm going to try to show you Jesus's sacrifice by showing you just what he went through.
I hate to even hear about those two scenes in the same sentence.
You watch that, though, and you get the sense that Spielberg said, I'm not going to give you the war scenes the way you've typically seen them in Hollywood films. I'm going to throw you into the muck. I'm going to show you just how awful this was. And I'm not going to need to trump up their heroism in any way. I'm just going to make you live through what they lived through.
The thing I've always wrestled with Saving Private Ryan is that opening scene, as striking as that is, and it certainly is on a visceral level, it's impossible not to be gripped by it. The rest of the film does do, I think, what you say. The first 20 minutes don't do, which is it bends over backwards to make you, you know, give you the triumphal.
I agree.
So it's that classic Spielberg tension.
Yeah, that's the reason why I have a mixed reaction to Saving Private Ryan on the whole.
That's why he's a fascinating filmmaker to talk about in any of his phases, because he's determined to comfort the audience, and just as he's determined to rough them up.
But that scene, Adam, I think is interesting, because whoever said there's no such thing as an anti-war movie, I think one measurement, and I don't know that Saving Private Ryan helps us answer that for some of the reasons you're mentioning, Michael, but I think that scene does make a distinction in that you want out of there. Mm-hmm. You want out of the theater, and maybe that's one level of an anti-war movie, is if you can't even take it anymore, as opposed to, yeah, this is violent and gruesome, but I want to see what happens.
Yeah.
In Saving Private Ryan, I just want it out of
You just
scene.
Want it to stop. You're right. It's not like Apocalypse Now, where Ride of the Valkyrie starts playing and it's sort of glorious watching them bomb these villages. You're right. There's nothing glorious about this. As Mark also said, I do think, at least I recall it as the first time I saw a film present war in that way. It's been imitated a million times since, but at the time, I'd never seen it done before. So Saving Private Ryan, the Omaha Beach sequence, is my number three. And my number two comes from a film that I said it last week on the show. I said it on Twitter a few weeks ago after I rewatched it. It's a movie I think is totally underrated. The Last Crusade, Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, the one with Sean Connery, the third film in the Indiana Jones series. It actually has a few superior elements to Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I, of course, considered the end sequence, the Choose Wisely sequence that I love from Last Crusade. But the standout for me is actually what happens just before the Choose Wisely Grail scene. It's the three challenges, or Only the Penitent Man Shall Pass. It's the sequence where Indy has to pass those three challenges in order to get to the Grail. And for me, it just showcases everything I love about the Indiana Jones series. The action of it combined with the mystery of these crucibles. And Indiana Jones having to use his intellect and having to use his learning to pass these challenges, not just brute strength. You layer on top of it Spielberg and his father-son infatuation. This is the scene where Indy is going through these challenges while cross-cutting between his father, Sean Connery, laying there potentially dying, but he's sort of narrating the path because he knows exactly what his son is going through, and he wants to basically be helping him, but of course can't because he's laying there on the ground. And you get some of that great Spielberg humor in there where Indy has to even put his Latin to the test.
Jehovah begins with an I. J.
The son we saw earlier in the film not wanting to go through his conjugations with his father, he knows his son's going to blow this and possibly step on the wrong letter. So I love the way it ties together the beginning of the film. It also culminates with Indy having to display his faith. He has to cross this chasm where he has to just step out into the void without seeing any kind of bridge or any kind of walkway.
Penitent man will pass. Penitent man.
before God.
If you go back to Raiders of the Lost Ark, this has been one of those themes running through this whole series, is Indiana Jones being a man of science and of learning, but not really being a religious man in any way. His father, that's one of the reasons they've had sort of a falling out, is his father is exactly the opposite. Also a man of learning, but definitely a man of faith as well. So that moment really ties together the entire series. We're just going to pretend for now that Crystal Skull didn't happen and just call it the trilogy. And that scene, Only the Penitent Man Shall Pass, is one that I've always loved.
So you'd really? put the Crystal Skull in with the Godfather, the third Godfather film, on a double bill.
Well, unfortunately, I famously liked that movie a lot more than a lot of people did.
The third Godfather?
Crystal Skull.
Yeah, I like Crystal Skull.
It's got awful aspects to it. But it also has a few redeeming moments.
You're on a Last Crusade high, aren't you?
I'm on a Last Crusade high. So included it. It's my number two. That brings us to our number one. We're sharing our all-time number one favorite Steven Spielberg scene. Michael, it is.
I hate to go back to the film I've already gone to, but we've talked about it, you know, time and again. The last 20 minutes of Close Encounters of the Third Kind is everything Spielberg is great at as a director. It's a genuine sense of wonder of the capabilities of the technological end of filmmaking and effects, all kinds of effects, and how to put them in the service of a story. And that film isn't neat and tidy. It is ungainly. It's not perfect. It's got a protagonist that throws a lot of people straight out of the film, and yet when I saw again for the first time in a long time, that film, especially the last 20-25 minutes, saw with my son, and to see it kind of work the magic with somebody, a jaded 11-and-a-half-year-old, was really kind of an inspiring thing. You know, it's like my memories weren't playing me false. So, yeah, to me, that's the two I love the most of his, for now, are Jaws and Close Encounters, and I could pick probably any two or three scenes from those, and they'd be the two or three examples, you know, I'd turn to at the moment. So anyway, yeah, the last 20 minutes of Close Encounters.
When you think about Spielberg having the audience in the forefront of his mind often, you do get the sense that that was probably set aside for that final 20 minutes to a certain degree, because he is just pursuing what he's interested in rather than where the narrative should go for any sort of traditional payoff.
Yeah, I think I have a different experience with Josh. My memory of seeing it, you know, the first six times when I was, you know, back in 77, and also re-seeing it, I think by then almost every audience that film played to, you know, by the time you really see, you know, the visitors coming in full force and on parade, essentially, you know, out there in the wilds of Wyoming, I think the movie is just completely casting a spell effectively. And it may seem a little indulgent, or that it's not necessarily moving the plot forward in sort of the usual tightly calibrated way. But I think it's just the wonder of the images is so potent that he knew what he was doing.
Well, my number one is also something that wowed me in the theater when I first saw it. It's from E.T., and it's the rescue by BMX bike that takes place at the climax with Elliot and his brother and his brother's friends. The moonlight ride with E.T. and Elliot is beautiful, but this BMX escape, I could do that. I was capable of that at the time, or I thought I could when I was 10. When Elliot rescues E.T., I love how he exclaims to his brother and his brother's friends, "Get the bikes. Meet us on the playground at the top of the hill." Because that's what so much of E.T. is about, is kids taking things into their own hands, and how often are their bikes used to allow them to do that. And that's what our lives were at that age. They were really revolved around our bikes. They're jumping ramps in this escape in places where the adults' cars can't fit. They go to this unfinished neighborhood where the houses are still being built that no one really hangs out in or lives in, but they have it as their area. That's where they escape through. And then, of course, the fantasy does intrude again, as it eventually will in a Spielberg film, when their bikes do go into the sky. The best touch for me is when they land, they all kind of do that sideways skid that makes you feel like, you know, when you were a kid, you thought you were really cool if you could pull off that sideways skid. So this scene is definitive Spielberg for me. It has extraterrestrial wonder. and kids' sneakers. It's like this beautiful combination.
Yeah. Well, my number one Spielberg scene is from the same film as Michael, your number one and number two. It's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and it's the scene where Barry, the little boy, the three-year-old boy, is abducted by the aliens, though we can question whether or not it's actually an abduction. It's the scene, for me, that I was most in awe of watching again as I revisited Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's also the scene, as it turns out, and I'm trusting my Spielberg guru, my buddy Scott Gladwin, who's the biggest Steven Spielberg fan I know. He says that Spielberg was once asked what his favorite scene is from any of his films, and he picked that abduction sequence. He described it this way. He said, that beautiful but awful light, just like fire coming through the doorway, and he's very small, and it's a very large door, and there's a lot of promise or danger outside the door. That's really Spielberg in a nutshell, and that's Spielberg at his best. That sense of promise, that sense of pure wonder that you've talked about, Josh, being drawn to the unknown, something you can't explain, but all caught up in that sense of danger and fear, being drawn to something you can't explain that might actually be very bad for you, you don't know. I think that contradiction dominates his best films and even appears in some of his worst films. And I mentioned whether or not this is really an abduction. That's how we think about it. The aliens come and they seem to be sort of imposing their will on the house and driving the boy from it, but they don't actually physically come and grab him. He goes through the door. He does see that light and decide to go in. He says, this is dangerous, but it's so wondrous, and he's three, he goes for it.
And I got to say, I love that scene. It's fantastic. But Roy gets a lot of flack in this movie. The mom
who lets him go.
She's, you know, a little lax in that scene.
I mean,
there's that one crouching in the kitchen moment where it's like she looks away a little too long.
He gets away. He gets away from her in this moment where any real parent in that scene would be clinging onto him for dear life.
It works overall.
I'm going to ignore that.
That scene is hilariously manipulative in the greatest way, because you don't know at that point in the story if these UFOs, if the extraterrestrials are in fact malevolent or not. And he's describing the light there in a way that sounds, you know, like a Spielberg cliche, because he's always dealing with like big spills and dumps of all kinds of light, just because it looks great and you can get a great silhouette, you know, out of any actor up against it. But there, it's perfect. It's perfect. That scene is perfectly calibrated, you know, that is a showcase, kind of a bravura sequence that he's just marvelous at. And even in films I don't love, like War Horse, you get a standalone 5-minute sequence like that. That attack, that World War One, is it a cavalry attack essentially? And then where it ends in is just a really miserable hail of bullets. And it's like stirring and then totally sobering in an instant. And that's so much better than most of the rest of the picture. But in Close Encounters, you get a scene like that, and it's just like, oh, man, this is exactly what we came for. This is why we go to the movies.
Well, those are our top five Steven Spielberg scenes. Guys, do you have any honorable mentions, any other picks you want to throw out there before we go?
Yeah, Michael, I thought you were going to mention the raptors in the grass in The Lost World, because it came up on an earlier show. I just love that moment.
And it's not much of a movie, the second Jurassic Park.
It's a terrible movie, actually, but I always remember that moment of them coming through the grass.
Great, and that's an example of what I'm talking about. It's not a scene. It's just simply 8 seconds or so. And it's just a beautifully staged. You know, the one thing that's always on my mind with Spielberg is that he's flirted a little bit with musical numbers, like the opening in the second Indiana Jones film. I don't know if you guys realize this. I'm not as sold on the Indiana Jones series as you guys.
Really?
I'm not quite there. But like in the opening of the second, you have this version of Anything Goes that Kate Capshaw sings. And the way Spielberg knows how to move the camera and move the actors and the camera around in this great sort of roundelay and this sort of dance together, it kind of breaks my heart. He's never made a full-on musical. Do you ever think that?
I thought it watching Temple of Doom over the weekend.
Yeah.
I did see that sequence and thought it's kind of interesting that he's never really embraced that and made an entire film that was a musical.
And you could do the song from Damn Yankees, You Gotta Have Heart. You know, if you want to remake Temple of Doom, the musical might have been better. Fabulous.
I think it most definitely would have been better. I could mention a lot of scenes that have come up from the movies that made my top five. I'll mention some picks that come from films that didn't make my final list. Raiders of the Lost Ark, somehow not making the cut. The Throw Me the Whip, the boulder, everything about the opening sequence.
I don't think it can be your favorite Spielberg film if you don't have a top five scene.
You can have a lot of A-minus scenes They don't have to be A-plus scenes.
That build up into his best film.
That's what I'm saying, John.
Don't buy it.
Of course, the E.T. scene you described, mainly the ride in the sky across the moon. The goodbye sequence, that for me, talk about nostalgia. When E.T. says goodbye, that's the first time I remember crying as a little boy at a movie. I'm with you on Minority Report. We talked about that, Michael. In War Horse, there's a sequence even better than the one you described, and it's the no man's land scene, where we get for that brief moment the truce between the two sides as they rescue Joey the horse, and a scene that comes from an earlier film but kind of mimics that no man's land scene. It's the safe house scene from Munich, where the Israeli officers, the people we've been following on their mission of revenge, end up going to a safe house to stay and encounter some PLO members. And there's this uneasy kind of tension there between them. I really love that scene as well. We want to know what Spielberg scenes you love. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Unless you have something to say about Hook, don't send that.
Exactly.
Don't even want to hear it, huh? You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out this weekend in limited release, opening here in Chicago, Anna Karenina, Silver Linings Playbook, and This Must Be the Place. This is a new dramedy starring Sean Penn and Frances McDormand.
Have you finished reading Anna Karenina yet?
I will not. I will do no such thing.
Come on.
I'm not going to spoil the movie
experience.
It's
a quick read. You'll get right through it.
Movies are way more important than books.
She totally gets run over by a train in that.
Now
oh,
it's ruined.
Oh, my goodness.
Now it's ruined. What about you? You were reading it. Did you finish it?
I did finish it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
well
now,
in advance.
Now you're going to give it a mixed review.
She doesn't get hit by a train at all, by the way.
Okay. Well, now I don't know what to believe. Out wide this weekend, The Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 2. And, as we said earlier, Lincoln expands to more screens after just opening in limited release last weekend. Next week on the show, we're going to take a little bit of a break for Thanksgiving. We won't have our usual show. We're going to have a preview of the film spotting Golden Bricks. We're going to highlight the leading contenders right now for our Brick Awards that recognize the best underseen, underappreciated films of the year. We're going to tell you how you can catch up with them if you haven't already and replay a couple of segments from the past year.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Michael Phillips, a pleasure as always. Where can listeners find you?
On Twitter, Phillips Tribune, and in the paper, in the dear old Chicago Tribune. It's at chicagotribune.com/movies, guys. It was fun.
Thank you for Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.